Well, let us turn in our Bibles to the book of Psalms and Psalm number 96. Psalm number 96. Although Psalm 96 doesn't officially have an author, in that it's not got the author's name just above the psalm, it may well be that it was originally written by King David. And the reason I say that is because in 1 Chronicles 16, we read of that occasion when David brought the ark back to Jerusalem. And in verse 7 of that chapter, we read these words: "That day David first committed to Asaph and his associates this psalm of thanks to the Lord." And if you look at that psalm of David's in 1 Chronicles 16, you'll see that the second half of it is virtually identical to what we have recorded here in Psalm 96. And so that might suggest that Psalm 96 was taken from that psalm of David's in 1 Chronicles 16 and placed here sometime after David had died. There was no copyright laws in those days, and therefore no legal requirement to acknowledge that it was originally David's composition. I say it's been put here after David's death because if you were with us a couple of weeks ago, then you may remember that I said that although the Psalms of books 1 and 2 were mostly written by monarchy and were written for the people of God during those years of monarchy, it seems that books 3 and 4 were put together for the good of God's people at a later stage in their history, and that later stage being the dark and difficult days of the exile. And so just as Psalm 90 was written about 1,000 years previously by Moses, so Psalm 96, it seems, was written about 400 years previously by David. But it's been put here in book 4 because it highlights a truth that the people of God in exile in Babylon desperately needed to hear. And that is the great truth of verse 10, that truth that we sang about in our opening hymn, and that is, the Lord reigns. The Lord reigns. To that generation in exile, the Davidic monarchy may have seemed to be a thing of the dim and distant past, and consequently they may have been tempted to think that God's rule in this world was now a thing of the dim and distant past. But what this psalm taught them was that nothing could be further from the truth. Even during their years in exile, their God continues to reign. And as we come to look at the details of this psalm, and we see a number of things, the first being in verses 1 to 6, and there we see the universal supremacy of our God. The universal supremacy of our God. The psalm begins with three exhortations to sing. The first of which is, sing to the Lord a new song. And on hearing that, you may be thinking to yourself here, just hang on a minute. If Psalm 96 is what they've been told to sing, then how can it be described as a new song if, as you've already suggested, it was written by David 400 years previously? 400 years old, how can you describe that as a new song? Well, when it says a new song, it doesn't necessarily mean a brand new composition. What it may mean is that it was a new song to the people who were singing it. And when you look at the next line of the psalm, that may well be what it means on this occasion, because the second exhortation is, sing to the Lord all the earth. Whereas Psalm 95, the previous psalm, if you're familiar with that one, whereas Psalm 95 begins with an exhortation for the Old Testament people of God to come and sing for joy to the Lord, Psalm 96 begins with an exhortation for the whole world to sing to the Lord. And for many people throughout our world, this would certainly have been a new song. It's a new song which would do two things. Firstly, verse 2, it would praise the Lord's name. And secondly, it would proclaim his salvation. And in singing such a song in all the earth, those singers would be, verse 3, they would be declaring the glory of God among the nations, his marvelous deeds amongst all peoples. Now, as the people of God in Old Testament times look back over their history, they could see the remarkable things that their God had done for them. For example, he had powerfully intervened during their time in slavery in Egypt, and in doing so, he had rescued them. He had miraculously saved them from bondage and tyranny, and it was such marvelous deeds that were to be proclaimed amongst all peoples on this earth. Now, when you think that the original readers of this Psalm 96 may well have been that generation in exile, the opening verses of this psalm might have come as quite a surprise to them. And the reason I say that is, having been taken captive by the Babylonians, there was perhaps a tendency for them to see themselves as a tiny minority in a hostile pagan environment. And therefore, they perhaps were in danger of thinking that they ought to keep their heads down, keep their mouth shut, and keep their religious convictions to themselves. But no, says the opening words of Psalm 96. Yes, you may be a small minority, but the name of our God ought to be praised by all the earth. The salvation of our God ought to be proclaimed throughout the world. And why? Well, as is usually the case in the Bible, when you're told to do something, you're usually given a good reason for doing it. And as is often the case in the Psalms, when you're given instructions to praise the Lord, you're often given a reason or rationale for doing so. And in this case, the rationale behind the radical instructions of verses 1 to 3 is given in verses 4 to 6. That is why verse 4 begins with the word for. Here is the explanation to the instructions in verses 1 to 3. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deeds among all peoples, for great is the Lord, and most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods. And the reason he is to be feared above all gods is verse 5. For all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Do you see the contrast between the Lord, Yahweh, and the various gods that are worshipped throughout the world? All those other gods are merely idols, says the psalmist. And don't forget Isaiah's description of an idol. Isaiah 40, verse 19. As for an idol, a craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. Imagine having to be worried in case your God happens to topple over. Idols, irrespective of whether they be of the metal type or the mental type, idols are essentially a product of man's imagination and the result of his handiwork. Or as Paul tells us in Romans chapter 1, they are created things. Whereas by comparison, second half of verse 5, the Lord made the heavens. That is the contrast between the false gods of this world and the true God. They are created things. He is the creator. They are dead, lifeless things that man has cobbled together, whereas he is the living God who has brought everything that you see round about you into being. And that is why, verse 6, splendor and majesty are before him, strength and glory are in his sanctuary. And going back to verse 4, that is why he is to be feared above all gods. You see, although being a small minority in a foreign pagan land, those believers exiled in Babylon, they don't need to be ashamed of their God. And neither do they need to feel intimidated by those around them who worship other gods. This psalm reminds them that it is their God who is the living, eternal, creator God, whereas the gods of the people around them are nothing other than the worthless, lifeless products of their own imagination. It is the Lord who is great, verse 4. It is therefore he who is worthy to be praised by people of every nationality. That is why there is the exhortation in verse 1, to sing to the Lord all the earth. And that is why there is the instruction in verse 3 to declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deeds among all people. That is the universal supremacy of our God. And many years later, you and I, as the people of God, need to be reminded of it. I say that because although we are not exiled to Babylon, we can nevertheless feel like a small, insignificant minority in a society where this God and that God and no God are being worshipped everywhere we look. And it is those gods that seem to be given all the prominence in our politics and in our media. Please note, I added no God to the list because the greatest threat to the social and moral and religious fibre of our society at the moment in time is, I believe, the secular materialistic atheism which most of the people around us blindly adhere to. That is the idol that is most commonly worshipped in our Western societies today, and that is the idol that, if we are not careful, can silence us and intimidate us as the people of God. And it is in the face of that idol, and whatever other idols we may be surrounded by, it is in the face of such idols that we need to remember, as that generation back in Babylon were reminded, we need to be reminded of the universal supremacy of our God. In contrast to the man-made gods of this world, the Lord is the creator. He is the one, as Paul said in idolatrous Athens that we read earlier in Acts chapter 17, he is the one who made the world and everything in it. He is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by men. He is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives men's life and breath and everything else. That is our God. And so rather than feeling intimidated, we can declare his glory and we can humbly and graciously and lovingly proclaim his marvelous deeds, not only to the unbelieving people of this society, but also to the unbelieving and unreached peoples across our world tonight. And let us not forget that from where we stand in history, we have more and even greater deeds of our God to tell them about. Yes, we can take them through Old Testament history, And we can show them how our God has miraculously come to the rescue of his people at the time of the exile. And then again at the time of the Exodus, and then again at the time of the exile. But then we can carry on throughout history and we can show them how God has come to our rescue supremely and finally in the person and work of his Son, Jesus Christ. And that is why Paul, you may have noticed, Paul finished his sermon in Athens with a resurrection, with a reference to the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. What other God has ever done such great things? That is the universal supremacy of our God. Secondly, verses 7 to 10, and there we see the universal honour deserved by our God. The universal honour deserved by our God. Now, whereas the psalm began with a threefold exhortation to sing, 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 the second half of the psalm begins with a threefold exhortation to give, give, give. Or as it is in most modern translations, ascribe, ascribe, ascribe. And what is it that we are to give or ascribe to the Lord? It is verse 7, glory and strength. It is verse 8, the glory due to his name. And one of the ways in which we do that, second half of verse 8, is by bringing an offering and coming into his courts. And on hearing that, you maybe think to yourself, but surely the inhabitants of Old Testament Israel, surely they would already have been very familiar with these sorts of instructions to give that sort of honour to their God. Yes, they would have been familiar with it. Although another reminder wouldn't do them any harm, especially following their years of idolatry and disobedience, which led to them being sent into exile in the first place. But although the inhabitants of Israel would have benefited from such a reminder, did you notice that these instructions to give, give, give are given to a much wider audience than the inhabitants of Old Testament Israel? Yes, it included them, but it also extended beyond them to verse 7, O families of nations. Verse 9, worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness, tremble before him all the earth. Just as there was an instruction in verse 1 for the whole earth to sing to the Lord, so these are instructions for the whole earth to give to him the glory and honour that he is worthy of. And on hearing that, you may be thinking to yourself, oh, but hang on a minute. It's one thing for David, assuming David wrote it, it's one thing for David to tell his fellow Israelites to give the Lord the honour that he is worthy of, because after all, he was their God and they were his people. They had signed up, as it were, to worship in this God. And so, yes, it's only but right that David should tell them to give their God the worship and the honour that he is worthy of. But isn't it a little bit cheeky of David, you may be thinking to yourself, isn't it a little bit cheeky of David to extend that instruction to the nations outside of Israel? Isn't it a bit over the top for David to tell the nations in verse 7 to ascribe to the Lord glory and strength? Is it a bit much for David to tell the whole earth to worship Yahweh and tremble before him? After all, those other nations, they've never signed up to serve in this God. And so what right has David to tell them about the worship and the honour that they ought to be giving him? Have you ever thought like that as a Christian? You may well have, because religion in our day has become a very personal and private thing. The common ethos of our society on matters of faith is that if you want to worship your God, then you're very welcome to do so. But don't you dare tell others that they too ought to be worshipping your God. It's none of your business, we're told, to tell other people what they should and shouldn't be doing, especially when it comes to such personal matters of faith and religion. And as a result of that prevailing ethos, we as Christian people have perhaps come to see our worship of God has been a very personal and private thing, something to be kept very much to ourselves. Or it may be that you're not a Christian this evening, and so you also find David's instructions to worship this God a little bit extreme and possibly even offensive. You may be thinking to yourself, I've never signed up to worshiping the God of the Bible, and until I do so, I'm not going to be taking instructions from anyone on that subject. Well, as I said earlier, when we are told to do something in the Bible, we are usually given good reasons for doing it. Please note, biblical Christianity is not a blind or mindless faith. It is instead a very reasonable and rational faith. And so once again, David provides us within this psalm with his rationale for issuing his universal instructions on worshipping his God. Firstly, as we've seen already in verse 5, this God is the Creator. He is our Creator, irrespective of where we live in the world, where we've come from. He is our Creator, irrespective of what religion or no religion that we subscribe to. He is our Creator. And being our Creator, we have responsibilities towards Him. It is the responsibility of the creature to worship the Creator. It is the responsibility of the creature to give the Creator the glory and the honor that He is worthy of. Secondly, verse 10, the Lord reigns. You see, having created this world, the eternal God didn't just then wash his hands of it and let it run randomly by itself. No, having created this world, God continues to rule his world. As the exiled generation had discovered, and as I'm sure we've felt at times, it's not always easy to appreciate why or how God is exercising his rule in our world today. But our lack of understanding doesn't limit God's ability to rule and reign throughout his world. And thirdly, verse 10, because it is this God who created our world, and because it is this God who rules this world, it is also this God who will one day judge this world. The world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Please note, not just his people, but the peoples. The peoples of the nations. The peoples of the whole world. Do you now see David's rationale for issuing his universal instructions on worship in verses 7 to 9, being the God who created the world, and being the God who rules our world, and being the God who will one day judge our world? Don't you think that it's perfectly reasonable for David to tell the whole world in verses 7 to 9 to worship this God? In view of the fact that this God is creator, in view of the fact that this God is ruler, and in view of the fact that this God is future judge, would it make sense to give our worship and our allegiance to some other God? Of course not. And that is why David tells us in verse 7 to 9, ascribe to the Lord O families of nations, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due to his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. That is the universal honor deserved by our God. Thirdly and finally, the universal judgment that will be executed by our God. Verses 11 to 13. Now, having brought verse 10 to a close with a reference to future judgment, the psalmist now issues an invitation to the whole creation to rejoice. Verse 11. Let the heavens rejoice. Let the earth be glad. Let the sea resound and all that is in it. Let the fields be jubilant and everything in it. Then all the trees of the forest will sing for joy. They will sing before the Lord. It's poetic language which points forward to a day when the created world will rejoice. And what day is that going to be? What event could possibly result in the rejoicing of the creation that we see all around us? We hear so much today about the damage that we human beings are doing to this earth. So what could possibly lead to the rejoicing of this earth? Well, did you hear David's answer to that question in verse 13? They will sing before the Lord, for he comes. He comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his truth. But why, you may be thinking to yourself, why would a future day of judgment possibly lead to the created world rejoicing? Well, to answer that question, we need to think about why the creation is currently not rejoicing. Or to put it in Paul's words in Romans 8, we need to think about why the creation is currently groaning rather than rejoicing. And the answer to that question is to be found away back in the third chapter of our Bibles, Genesis chapter 3, because there we learn that man's rebellion towards his creator not only had consequences for mankind, it also had consequences for the creation which mankind had been given the responsibility of looking after and caring for. That is why our planet is not what it once was. And that is why our planet does not always function as it should. As Paul says in Romans chapter 8, the creation has been subjected to frustration. But what Paul goes on to say in Romans 8 is that there is coming a day when the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay. That is the great future day that Psalm 96 is looking forward to. But please note, the thing which will bring about that day, the liberation of creation from its bondage to decay, the thing that will bring about that day is not net zero. I'm sure you're familiar with net zero. That's our great target, to reduce our carbon emissions to net zero. It's not net zero that will bring about that day, or any other environmental initiative for that matter. There is a future day when God returns to this world in judgment. And the reason that day of judgment will result in the liberation of creation is because it is on that day that men and women's rebellion towards their creator will finally be judged. And as the closing verse of the psalm makes clear, that will be a universal judgment. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his truth. And the question we all need to ask ourselves, in the light of that coming day, the question we all need to ask ourselves is, are we prepared for that day? Do you remember how Paul brought that sermon in Athens to a close? Acts chapter 17, verse 30. He says, in the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. The man who was raised from the dead is Jesus. And Paul is saying that the resurrection of Jesus in the past is proof of a coming universal judgment that is going to be executed by Jesus. His resurrection in the past is proof of that coming day. And the great news tonight is that you and I can be ready for that coming day of judgment. We can be ready because prior to his resurrection from the dead, Jesus had died for rebellious sinners like you and me. He had taken the sinner's place and he had suffered the sinner's punishment. And that is why we no longer need to bring an offering as we come into God's presence, as described in verse 8 of the psalm. The type of offering that David was asking for there would no doubt have been an animal sacrifice which pointed forward to the sufficient and final sacrifice of Jesus Christ upon the cross. But as we sang earlier in the service, we no longer need to bring that offering because Jesus paid it all. And through trusting, through relying completely in what Jesus has done in his life, death, and resurrection, you and I can have our rebellion towards our Creator completely forgiven. And in doing so, we can become a willing worshipper of God. The type of worshipper described in Psalm 96, a worshipper who sings to the Lord, a worshipper who proclaims his salvation, a worshipper who declares his glory among the nations, and who tells of his marvelous deeds among all peoples. Through trusting in Christ, you and I can become the worshippers of Psalm 96. Three things we see in Psalm 96. We see the universal supremacy of our God. We see the universal honor deserved by our God. And thirdly, we see the universal judgment that will be executed by our God.